This is a podcast from Minute Media.
Hello and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me as usual is Rich. Hello, Rich.
Hey, what's going on?
Oh, you know, just we got through another season. Got NBA Finals is done. Golden State Warriors are on top again. Quite a surprise, actually, I guess, you know, given where they've been for the last couple of years, even though, of course, you know, they've been one of the great dynasties of recent times. The fact that they came back this year and did what they did, pretty exceptional. You know, as we were looking for some topics to do, sort of, you know, as the playoffs wrapped up, decided that, you know, one that would be interesting for us would be to talk about the players who can truly call themselves the best on a championship team.
Yeah, and I will say that we probably got more excited about this topic. Well, I'm still excited about this topic, but I want to say that I think our, like, initial conversation of, like, hey, this is going to be a great idea, I believe was when Boston was up 2-1 in the finals, and we're like, whoa, you know what? Like, there's a case to be made that Jason Tatum's not even the best player on this team. Like, maybe it's, you know, Jaylen Brown, or, hey, Al Horford's playing great. Like, let's, you know, and then we kind of got going, and now it's like, you know, in hindsight, it'll be very easy to answer 2022. It's Steph Curry. He was the best player on the Warriors. Maybe Andrew Wiggins. Maybe we'll have that conversation later, but I think it's Steph Curry. But yeah, it would have been a little bit more of a fun conversation with Boston, since they seem like, you know, to have a little bit more competition in this sense. But then it got us thinking, well, how many other times has this happened? How many other times is it, like, not completely 100% obvious who the best player is on the championship team? And believe it or not, it's more frequent than you would think. You would think, oh yeah, it's a title team. Most title teams need a star to be great or whatever. It's that guy. It's whoever that star is. But, you know, most people that watch NBA or follow NBA history know that it's usually not one star. It's usually a couple stars. And that leads then to this very interesting discussion that we're going to have, that there's really only a handful of, like, teams where you're like, oh yeah, boom, it's definitely this guy. And there are a lot more in history where it's like, I don't know, there's 2-3, you know, people that would legit have claims to be the best player on a championship team. And I think that was a little surprising to me when we started going through and picking out, you know, the years and the names.
Yeah, and it's very difficult to parse credit, obviously. I mean, you know, even modern era, with, you know, the numbers that we have and the ability to analyze the game that, you know, we have in this era, it's difficult now, much less, you know, 50s and 60s, where, you know, the much fewer stats, much more difficult, you know, the accounts are not as detailed. So, you know, this is just going to be our best guess on a lot of these, which, you know, is fine.
Oh, no, no, this is official. Right. Like, all these people are officially it. No, I don't know what you're talking about. No, this is official. Set it in stone. If any of the players that we didn't mention got finals MVP, they must now turn those in. Luckily, a lot of these years are going to be pre-finals MVP that we're going to do in this particular part. So that's fine. They don't need to take anything away from them. Maybe they can give some of these guys. We'll make trophies. I'll make trophies. I'll get it. I'll send them to all these. I just need these guys' addresses. So.
All right. We'll figure that out. Yeah.
Some of them are dead, so that's gonna be tough, but I'll give it to the estate, you know. I'll contact the estate of several of these people, but yeah, no, I think this is official, and we are the true arbiters, and we are correct on every single one of our picks is how I'm approaching this, but I guess you can approach your way if you'd like as well. So
all right, well, we can go our own way, as Philo Mac said, so.
Yeah. Oh man, that's not good. Well, I guess they still made some great music for a while, you know. Yeah, we could not really like each other, but still make some great podcasts. So.
That's a fair thing. Yeah, we're trying to approach. We've liked each other for 8 years. Maybe we could try.
Yeah, let's try something different. Yeah, you know, what? Cool. Screw you.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Hey.
I can't even do it. I can't even fake do it. No, that's not nice. You're very nice.
There you go. Well, thanks, Rich. I think you're nice too.
I can't even do it. Can't even fake it. All right.
Yeah. There you go. Well, anyway, we are not limiting this just to the NBA. We're going to cover the ABA as well. We're going to cover the BAA and the NBL. Of course, the two leagues that formed to merge the NBA in 1949. Is a big topic. We're going to be.
Oh, I don't know. NBA history tells me very differently. Jason, are you kidding me? Like, what are you talking about? Because this is the NBA 75th year that we just concluded the NBA 75th year. You know that?
Right. I've heard that. Yeah.
We weren't as annoying as people thought, to be fair. We weren't as annoying as people thought. We kind of let it go because the NBA kind of let it go too. They did a little bit of, like, here's this diamond logo. And then, like, when a game would start, or, like, when they would come back from commercial, they'd show, like, Bill Russell for a second and be like, NBA 75. And it's like, all right, okay. I guess the All-Star game, they did a little bit more, but.
They did. It's a losing battle to a degree. So we can just be right, and that's fine. You know, we don't need to push it too hard. But
there it is.
So, yeah. But, yeah, so, Yeah, big topic. We're going to do two shows on this. The first episode is going to go through 1974, and then we'll cover the rest of the years in a future show. So, yeah, there's a lot of these. So there are quite a number of them, although not the majority, that definitely it's very clear who the best player is. No real need to discuss it. And those are the following. Joe Fuchs in 1947 for the Philadelphia Warriors, not the Philadelphia Warriors. That is not a real basketball team. So, yeah, like the Bobcats, not a real team. George Mikan for the 1947 Chicago American Gears and the 48 through 50 and 53 through 54 Lakers. One year we're going to discuss here that where it's a little bit up in the air. But Mikan obviously, you know, pretty much gets it every other time. Dolph Schayes for the 1955 Nationals. Bill Russell for the 59 through 63 Celtics. The other Celtics years we will discuss. Will Chamberlain for the 1967 76ers. Connie Hawkins for the 1968 Pittsburgh Pipers of the ABA. Zelmo Beatty of the 1971 Utah Stars of the ABA. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, then Lew Alcindor for the 1971 Milwaukee Bucks. The couple of Lakers years are going to be worth discussing with him and Magic. Walt Frazier for the 1973 Knicks. 1970, we will discuss. Julius Erving, the 74 and 76 New York Nets. Artis Gilmore for the 1975 Kentucky Colonels. Rick Barry for the 75 Golden State Warriors. Dave Cowens for the 1976 Celtics. Bill Walton for the 1977 Trailblazers. Magic Johnson for the 82 and 87 and 88 Lakers. Larry Bird for the 84 and 86 Celtics. 81's a more interesting discussion than you might think.
Yeah, yeah. I can't wait for that one.
Michael Jordan for the Bulls six championships. Akeem Olajuwon for
Horace
the...
Horace Grant erasure. Okay. All right.
I know.
All right. Wow. That's why he was so mad when he was in Orlando. He's like, screw this. I'm not getting the love. But all right. All right. Yeah. You're just going to immediately give Jordan also. Okay. All right.
I guess I'm going to go ahead and agree with the last dance on this one.
You know, yeah. So. Wow. All right.
I know. Yeah.
I think it's more of a debate. It's not a debate.
No, all right. It's not. Akeem Olajuwon for the 94-95 Rockets. Shaquille O'Neal, 2000 and 2002 Lakers. 2001, we're going to discuss a little bit. Kobe might have a little bit of a case there, but we'll get into that, of course. Tim Duncan for the 2003 Spurs. The other Spurs years we'll get into. Dwayne Wade, 2006 Heat. Dirk Nowitzki, 2011 Mavericks. LeBron James, 2012 and 2013 Heat, 2016 Cavs. And you might be like, well, about Dwayne Wade for 2012 and 2013? Yeah, not even close.
You'll find out. Yeah, you'll quickly find out that the reason the Heat got really good is they said, all right, LeBron, you're going to be the guy.
Yeah.
Wade, you're cool. You can still do a lot of stuff, but we're going to let LeBron kind of run the show here.
Yeah.
And you can be the secondary guy. And then it led to two titles and dominance and some of the greatest years. I mean, some of those LeBron years. I mean, and it's going to be eye-opening, again, to kind of go back and look at those. I mean, they're just... He's stupid good in those seasons. It's not even close. It's not even close. Right.
Yes. So Steph Curry, 2015 and 2022, as we've declared already. Yeah, I know. You want to throw some Andrew Wiggins in there?
No, and I really don't. But all right. You could if you were dumb. But no, I'm not going to. But you could.
Yeah.
But you probably shouldn't.
Probably should. No. Kawhi Leonard in 2019 for the Raptors. 2014, we'll discuss in for the Spurs. And Giannis Antetokounmpo in 2021 for the Milwaukee Bucks. No arguments for any of those, Rich?
I don't think so. Yeah, I think I'm pretty good. I know some people might scoff at the Lakers ones. Like 2000, I think, is not a debate between Shaq and Kobe. I mean, Shaq is so much more dominant. 2002, you start, like we said, 2001 is a debate, and we will get into that one. That one is interesting. 2002 is also one that I think if you really dig into the numbers, you might think on your head or on its face, like, oh, that's when Kobe really started to emerge. And yeah, but like Shaq was insane in those playoffs. And we're going to talk about that in a bit. I mean, he had his way with everybody in the West. And then, of course, with the Nets in the finals. So we'll talk about that one. I don't think that's much of a debate. I could see some people making that debate. Otherwise, I think you pretty much nailed every other one in my mind. I think there's no real debate for any of those other guys. Some of the Lakers Celtics years get a little tricky but I think the ones that you named right there are definitely Magic and definitely Bird in all those years. So yeah, I really have no complaints. I think it's pretty solid.
All right. Well, if we as we get into those times, if there's any of those we want to look over, there's nothing stopping us from doing that. But again, yeah, those are for the most part, I think, are pretty crystal clear. So the ones that are worth debating, we'll get started on those. We are going to choose the 1946 Royals as our starting point. The Rochester Royals. This is the NBL. This is pre-BAA. But reason kind of chose this one. This is the first NBL season after the war. The schedule and the talent roster, of course, are reduced in the early 40s. You know, the NBL expands. They've got a whole lot of talent. A lot of those guys, of course, played, you know, a basketball in the military. You know, service ball was kind of a big thing. So a lot of guys, there was a lot of exposure between you guys who had never played together before, different styles, et cetera. So, you know, the game is evolving and, you know, obviously entering into its major league era. So Rochester Royals, they were an expansion team that year. Their top players. So their forward center, George the Blind Bomber Glamic. Yes.
I love this guy's story. This is awesome.
Yes, the Blind Bomber. He was first team NBL that year. He led the team in points per game at 12.3. He's ninth all time in career NBL points. So one of the best scorers of that league's history. So according to Wikipedia, it says there's a reference to the Spalding Guide that says Glamic, who is ambidextrous when on the court, is also so nearsighted that the ball is merely a dim object, but apparently he never looked where he was shooting, depending on his sense of distance and direction. Apparently his secret was looking at the black lines on the court. By doing that, he knew where he was in reference to the basket and was able to measure the shot. So Blind Bomber.
not enough nearsighted blind players in today's NBA, I don't think. Yeah, so he's like, he's like a snake or something. He's like picking up on vibrations and lines. Yeah. And I love it.
Yeah,
I love it. But it worked. Yeah. You know, it worked for the Blind Bomber. I think somebody should do this too. Like, not look up, just look down, look at the black line and shoot and see what happens. You know,
absolutely. Yeah.
A lot of people look at the basket these days, jump. I don't know. Maybe should start taking. You know, it seemed to work for the Blind. That's a great story. I love that. That is just classic NBL 46, you know, just old school stuff there. But great nickname. No great nicknames like the Blind Bomber anymore. We're not getting anymore.
We don't really get anything like that anymore. Yeah. So next we got Rhett Holzman. Of course, he was a rookie of the year for the league. He was also first team all league. In his career, he had two first team and one second team all NBL appearances. So he was, you know, elite player in his day, at least for a short period of time. And of course, to be a future coaching legend, he's in the Hall of Fame, but as a coach. The Blind Bomber, unfortunately, not in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, maybe we should see what we can do about that. But Al Servi, he was a second team all league. He was known as a scrappy, tough defender, the nickname of Digger. He had three times first and two times second all league appearances in his career. Actually started in the NBL in 1938 out of high school. Then he served in the military from 1940 to 45, then returned to the NBL at age 28, played until age 35 in the NBA, a very rare feat in its day. He's also in the Hall of Fame as a player. And then Bob Davies, who's probably the most famous of these players in terms of, you know, he was probably the most elite career of these guys. He was a rookie, you know, next to Bob Cousy, probably the best point guard of his era. He would have five first and two times all league teams in his career. Five times first, two times second in his career. Hard to know. We're really thin on the stats. We basically have, you know, we know what their free throw percentage is, and we know what their points per game is. Don't know a whole lot more. Obviously, you know, the league honors here. You know, Davies had the strongest pro career this group. Servi was pretty much close second. Davies and Holzman were the only two players on both the 46 NBL and 51 NBA title teams. They were an expansion team, as mentioned, so they had no one on their team had been in the league the prior year. There's really no good year-to-year comparison about, okay, how did the Royals do the previous year with a new player or whatever. And they also made the two finals after this, which largely the same group. So it's sort of like, all right, how do you determine it? So I guess, you know what, I'm just going to go with the Blind Bomber, you know, like,
I think that's the only correct pick, just for nickname purposes, just coolness fact. I mean, just cold, calculated, looking at the black line, shooting, not looking at the basket. Yeah. It's gotta be the Blind Bomber for sure.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, it's, anyway, the Royals this year, they dethroned the two-time defending champ Pistons with a four-time NBL MVP, Bobby McDermott. They also cruised past the powerhouse Sheboygan Redskins.
Oh, they made the big win. NBL big finals. Win against the Sheboygan Redskins.
Yeah. They made five NBL finals in 6 years to win their title, so they did dethrone the powerhouses of the league. Also, a fun fact, the Royals had future three-time NFL MVP Otto Graham and future TV star Chuck Connors would also play a bit in the BAA. on the roster as role players. Graham actually was on the Connors was cut before the championship team, but Graham was part of the championship team win. So certainly exciting times.
Yeah, that's an awesome. I mean, geez, that's a hell of a athletic career. You know what I mean?
Right.
To be like play professional basketball and, you know, be one of the best, you know, in the early days of the NFL, one of the best players in professional football history as well. So yeah, right. Good for him.
Yeah. There you go. Good old Otto.
All right, let's move on to the 1948 Bullets, the Baltimore Bullets here in 1948. Very balanced team scoring-wise, six players averaging between 12 points per game and 10.5 points per game. Not among the original BAA teams. They defected from the ABL, which we have talked about on the show before. More of an East Coast league that had long ago been a major league, but by this point, it's, I don't know exactly how to describe it. What would you call the current state of the ABL at this time? More of a just completely regional, completely I don't know. It definitely got swallowed up and passed by the other leagues there, but they defect from the ABL to the BAA in 1948. This is a two-person race with some apologies to some of our other favorite players of all time. Cleggy Hermanson, who we talked about before.
We love Cleggy. Yeah.
Chick Reiser. Sorry, Chick. Not this time. Mike Bloom. And even rookie of the year, Paul Hoffman. Sorry, guys. You're out of the running here. It is a two-horse race between Buddy Genette and Connie Simmons. So Buddy Genette was late in his brilliant career. He had played in the NBL, the ABL, BAA, and NBA as well, earning four first-team league honors, two-time second team. He won four rings, plus four championships in the World Professional Basketball Tournament, which was another weird thing that I want to learn a little bit more about this. I saw it in these notes here. I saw it in a little bit as we were researching, but I don't know that we've ever talked about this
we should definitely do a show on covering that because it was really interesting thing for its time. And we'll make a note to put this one on the list of future ideas.
Kind of like an invitational team between some of the best pro leagues and pro teams and kind of NCAA tournament style, but all for like pros, you know, with all these different leagues all over the place or whatever, coming together for, okay, who's the best of the best, you know, now, you know, before the NBA finals, before all these teams are kind of in one or two leagues or whatever, it's now a little bit more fun where it's, you know, you're getting people from all over the country or whatever coming to find out who the best of the best is. But you'll have to check that out. But twice he was MVP of that as well. So insane credentials overall. Even though it took until 1994 for him to make the Hall of Fame, he did eventually make it. He was 20th in the BAA in points per game, 10.6. 7th in assists per game, 1.5 assists. Assists were hard to come by in 1948 because, guys weren't really making many shots. So you'd pass to them, and then a lot of times they would not make the shot, so you didn't get an assist. But he was first in true shooting as well. He actually was a pretty great shooter at 45.4%. And with this title, he became, as far as we could tell, the first ever player coach to win a pro sports championship. I don't know. Maybe there's probably some, but as far as we could tell, as what some other people have said, he is the first player coach to win a pro championship.
It said that in Wikipedia, which I'm like, well, didn't any manager players ever win in baseball? But I don't know. Anyway, that's
That's not our, you know, we're not experts on every professional sports field. I feel like that's hard to believe, but I don't know. We'd have to dig in a little bit more. But
all right.
He is also, thankfully, one of the few links between the original Baltimore Bullets, who then folded in 1954. So there was an original Baltimore Bullets that's not technically related to what eventually became the Baltimore and Washington Bullets, but he is a part of both of those. He was a part of that original Baltimore Bullets that folded in 1954, and then the current Wizards franchise slash the former Baltimore Bullets as he coached them during the mid-60s. So that is awesome, being a chain between both of those. And then we have Connie Simmons. I played only 13 regular season games for the Bullets in 1948. He came over from the Boston team. His case, though, comes completely in the 11 playoff games where he was awesome. 17.1 points per game, 44.9 true shooting, 7th best in the 48 postseason. He led the team in playoff win shares at 2.5. Now, Genette, he would average, you know, 8.8 points in the playoffs on a very efficient, especially at that time, 61% true shooting. He has a 2.1 playoff win shares. So he didn't stink, but I think you can pretty I'm pretty safe in saying that Connie Simmons with that 17.1 points per game, which is nuts in this era too. I mean, just absolutely nuts scoring output. I think Simmons has the case for the better postseason. But then it's tough because then you have Buddy Jeanette, who has the crazy credentials, one of the all-time greats, all that sort of stuff. And then Simmons, who's just kind of never made an all-league team or even an all-star team. He just had a really, really good playoffs. I don't know. This one's a bit of a toss-up. I think Buddy probably gets it just based off the credentials and based off, you know, him being a more important player overall to this Bullets franchise. But you could definitely make a case for Connie, just given what he did in the playoffs. But I think I'm going with Buddy here.
Yeah, and I would, you know, and you and I probably, obviously we have slightly different criteria in what we're thinking here, but I'm sure. But I would give it, I mean, it's not just, yeah, who's the guy who's playing the best when they win the championship. Obviously, they need to have a body of work over the season. Correct. And over the, yeah, and over their careers. That's, you know, but yeah, I mean, if Jeanette had really struggled in the playoffs and, you know, Simmons maybe had been more the part of the team or had some other credentials, I would have maybe given to Simmons. But yeah, I would definitely say overall, I would go with Buddy as well. All right, next we have the 1949 Anderson Packers, formerly the Anderson Duffy. Actually, they were still the Anderson Duffy Packers at this point because this is their last season in the NBL. They would become the Anderson Packers, losing the Duffy when they came to the NBA. In any case, this franchise based in Anderson, Indiana, debuted professionally in the NBL in the 1947 season. They were founded by brothers Ike W. and John B. Duffy, who were the owners of the meatpacking company Duffy's Incorporated. They actually formed the team when they acquired a local Anderson meatpacker. So, yeah, the Packers, they spent 3 years in the NBL before they became part of the merger with the BAA. They lasted only 1 year in the NBA, along with Waterloo and Sheboygan. They then moved on to the NPBL, which also lasted 1 year. However, they do have the they do definitely they were the last NBL champions. They have that in their pocket, so they will always be remembered, at least by us and by a few NBL historians. Not so much by the NBA itself, unfortunately.
No.
But yeah,
I wonder how Anderson, Indiana treats there. Yeah, we've always said we needed someone to greenlight the project where we go to these like random cities. Like I want to walk around Sheboygan and just be like, hey, what do you know about Sheboygan? And then be like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah,
like that'd be great. That'd be great. Someone's got to greenlight that. I don't know who else would watch it. It's like, you know, maybe exclusively the listeners to this podcast, Curtis and me and you, and our parents will probably send it to them. They'll watch it. You know? I don't have to watch the whole thing, but they'll watch some of it.
Five minutes of it. Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But that'd be great. You know what I mean? Let's do that. Let's get someone to fund that.
You and I could realistically, I mean, obviously, you know, you live in Chicago. I live in
Ohio, a lot of these are not that far. We could drive to pretty much every single one of these.
Yeah. You and I realistically could do that anyway. Another show idea apparently, but okay. Yeah. So the 49 Packers, you know, they were very balanced. Their best candidates for best player are probably guard Frankie Bryan was on the first team, guard Ralph Bogue Johnson, or forward Bill Kloss. Both of those were on the second team. By far the best career was had by Bryan. He was one-time all first team and 3 times all second team in his career. Also, he was Bob Pettit's cousin, of a fun fact there. So they both played for LSU. He was top 10 in points per game 3 times in his career. He was a third in the league in 1950 in the NBA and was 8th in assists per game in 1951. So, you know, among the best scorers and assists during his time. Johnson or Kloss never had any league honors beyond the 49 seasons. So, pretty much by default, just going to go ahead and go with Bryan here. You know, stats-wise this year, again, they were all very balanced. But of the three, you definitely would say that Bryan was probably, he had 9.9 points, per game versus, Johnson had 8.1, although he did step it up into the playoffs at 12.3. All three, again, relatively the same production during that year. Kind of hard to parse out the credits. So going to go with the player with the best historical honors for sure. Interestingly enough, all three of these players would make their way to the Fort Wayne Pistons, who had hired the former Packers coach Murray Mendenhall, and Bryan would end up lasting long enough to be on the 1955 and 1956 Pistons teams that made the NBA Finals.
Yeah,
so
that's awesome.
Fun facts. Yeah.
Let's move on to the 1951 Rochester Royals. And I do think Rochester still loves the Royals. I think we every so often there'll be an article in like the local Rochester paper talking about like people giving their memories of the Rochester Royals or whatever. Yeah. So
that's
I think they still love it. Yeah.
But Rochester probably not going to make it on a road trip.
That's pretty far. I'm not going all the way there. We'll go to the Indianas and the Wisconsins. And I don't think I'll make it to Rochester.
Illinois, maybe. Right. Yeah, probably not. Yeah.
Sorry, Rochester. But I'll just assume that they love the Rochester Royals and still care very, very deeply about them. So this is a big year for the Royals of Rochester. They finally break through in the new NBA after being bested by the George Mikan-led teams the previous 3 years. But the Royals, they're a great team right now. They have Red Holzman. They have Bob Davies from their 1946 NBA title team that we talked about before. Davies was still one of the top players on the roster, 15.2 points per game, 4.6 assists per game, 6.9 win shares, which is an awesome number for this time. He was All-NBA first team that season as well. The other two candidates with the strongest cases are also both future Hall of Famers as well. Arnie, Big Slim Rizin, again, great nicknames, 16.3 points per game, 12 rebounds per game, and then Bobby Hook Swanzer at 10.8 points per game, three-time All-NBA second team in his career as well. Winshares also likes another Arnie. There's a lot of Arnies on this team. The NBA had a lot of Arnies in these days. Yep, not so much anymore. Yep. Not too many Arnies playing these days, but this is Arnie. Old Ironsides Johnson. Incredible. 9.1 win shares for him, slightly behind Ryzen's team leading 9.3 win shares. This team rocks. There's so many great players on this team. He earned 9.4 points per game on a team best, 56.4 true shooting. And of course, Johnson, the pride of Bemidji State. Are we going Bemidji? I don't know. I've never been to Bemidji, Minnesota. Am I saying that correctly?
I feel like I remember Bemidji. Maybe Bemidji. I believe it was first season of Fargo. I believe Bemidji gets referenced.
Incredible. So this is the Beavers, the Bemidji State University Beavers. Bemidji Beavers, Johnson, the pride, old Ironsides, the pride
he's
of...
only NBA player from a Bemidji State University.
Shockingly, I can't believe that's true. Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Where did Ben Simmons... No, he was LSU, right? Okay, all right, he wasn't Bemidji State. Okay, all right, yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, I'm trying to think of other great Bemidji State players off the top of my head, but... And none coming to my mind immediately. So you're probably right on that pack there. In terms of win shares, Davies and Wanzer are distant third and fourth, surprisingly, right around the same level of Jack Old Rancher Coleman, another strong contributor to the team as well. Man, there is so many great nicknames in the 1950s NBA. We have to do just an entire show. But I feel like other eras, I'd say the 70s got some pretty good nicknames going too, but the 50s might be the best of all time. The current era is the dirt worst, of course.
Yeah,
because either nobody wants a nickname, or it's like first name, last name, or just, you know, I don't know. The nicknames are terrible these days.
The only thing you got to worry about in the 50s is like if any of them have like a racist origin.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's like because like the MLB has like great nicknames for a long time. But then it's like every Indian player is named Chief. You know what I mean? Every Native American guy, they're like, that's Chief over there. Yeah. And it's just like, like just horrific nicknames that you're like, oh, man, like, why did you have to do that? That's a terrible nickname. But that's the only problem. But I'd say the NBA, I mean, there are a few. It's it's 1950s America. There's going to be a few. Right. But I'd say most are pretty pretty solid. Jack Old Rancher Coleman is just, that's a great one.
That's a great one,
But when it comes to playoff time for these, Wanzer leads his team in win shares at 2.7. Johnson is second at 2.4. Arnie Rizin is at his third, 2.1. So it's pretty close between those three. Davies, a distant fifth at 0.8. Way to show up, Bob. Only 41.2% win true shooting percentage, which hurts him a little bit. So we're actually going to get some help from, and we're going to do this throughout a lot of this as well. We're going to get some help from our friend Curtis Harris, who very recently on Pro Hoops History, prohoopshistory.substack.com, did the Lost Finals MVPs, because at this time, there is no Finals MVPs. There is no postseason awards at this time. So Curtis Harris did that. He went through all the years that did not have NBA Finals MVPs and selected one. He gave Arnie Rizin the award here at 50... the 1951 Finals MVP, 21.7 points per game, 14.3 rebounds per game. That is pretty tough to argue with. So we have declared it. Big Slim, Arnie Rizin, is the best player on the 1951 Rochester Royals.
Yeah, I'm behind that one.
He's pretty great.
Yeah, he was pretty great. Yeah, he was a great player in his day. You know, one of the better big men. He only had like one all NBA or all BAA honor, I think, first team. But he's also behind Mike and a couple other guys like Neil Johnson in terms of the great centers. He was right at that next level. You know, some of the centers get hurt with those awards thing because there's only one center spot where with forwards and guards, it's obviously two spots. So on those, you know, all NBA teams. But yeah, so the only thing I feel a little bad about, I guess, is that, like, I mean, Davies historically probably is the best player from that whole, you know, Rochester Royals era from, you know, 46 through 51, but, you know, doesn't get named the best player on either team, you know, and, it's hard to really make a case for him. I mean, he was obviously one of the better players in the regular season, but I think the playoffs, tanking in the playoffs, I think hurts him. And then 46, he wasn't quite established well enough. So I think individually both cases make sense, but I feel a little bit like off, like, oh, like historically he was probably the best player, you know, throughout that entire time, and yet doesn't get the kudos that I feel like he deserves overall, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, but we're going to keep it. So that's sorry, Bob Davies.
Too bad, Bob.
Too bad. Yeah. Too bad, Bob.
Should have a better nickname.
Exactly. All right, so 1952 Lakers, as we mentioned, all the other Lakers dynasty years. George Mikan, very clear, 52, only time worth in which there's a debate about it. And honestly, it's not that much of a debate, but we're going to go with it.
For
anyway,
the purposes of this show, we'll debate it a bit. But yeah, you'll maybe see when it's all done. But
right. So, you know, obviously, they weren't just George Mikan. They also were Vern Mikkelson, who I think has a case for this season. Jim Pollard and Slater Martin were also Hall of Famers, and you know they were on the team for all or most of that 1948 through 1954 dynasty. They won six titles in 7 years. Mikan also won a seventh title with the 1947 Chicago American Gears in the NBL before that team folded, and then he ended up with the Lakers. But anyway. 1952, Mikkelson did lead the team in win shares per 48, very, very close, 270 to Mikan's 268. So, you know, percentage points difference. He was a more efficient scorer, 490 true shooting versus 459. Really, that's the only statistical advantage he had. You know, you look at raw numbers, Mikan, 23.6 points per game, 15.9 rebounds per game to Mikkelson's 13.3 and 8.5 respectively. And Mikan significantly outplayed him in playoffs. So really, yeah, I was looking at this. I was like, I thought there was a case at first, and then I looked at it more deeply. I'm like, yeah, actually not really. But,
it's worth a try. You got to try at least. But George is, he was good.
He was really damn good. And people, I think, don't appreciate that. And I understand there's certain reasons why, you know, maybe this era why this era is looked upon without favor. But yeah, he was really, really good. And interestingly enough, Mikan's win shares total between the 1949 and 1954 seasons, which was 107.1, nearly equal to the combined totals of Mikkelson, Pollard, and Martin during the same period of 110.9. So basically, you know, four more win shares between those three players than Mikan had on itself. Now, win shares, obviously, not perfect, but, you know, it tells a story, and it tells a really interesting story here.
Yeah, he's it's sometimes it's easy to kind of forget and just kind of do, oh, yeah, well, that league, you know, no, there was a lot of great players at that time. And Mikan was so much better than almost everybody. You know what I mean? Like, he is significantly better. I know that people initially just look and go, oh, he's got glasses. He looks like a dork. The league, you know, just like people just don't respect him. But like, all you can do is play in the era that you played in. You know what I mean? Like, George Mikan could do is play in the era he played in. And what he did in the era he played in was be like so incredibly great and so just insanely, insanely great. That right there, three great players in that time period, like you're saying, and all three of those equal George Mikan's win shares on its own. I mean, come on. This guy is incredible. He's just an incredible player. Don't get caught up in the BS of, oh, they're these plumbers and whatever. I forget what the current quote going around is or whatever. I forget who J.D. Redick or something said. I mean, George Mikan was incredible. All you can do is play in the area you played in, and he played fucking incredible. So, there we go. Mini rants on George Mikan. Let's go to the 1956 Philadelphia Warriors. I think this is a interesting debate here. I think there's two guys that at least have a potential case here. Again, if you want more details on this, Curtis Harris, prohoopshistory.substack.com, wrote a great piece on this one as well. But I believe it's between Neil Johnston and Paul Arizin. And those are two, you know, and those guys would bounce back and forth between, you know, being the more important players in this time, obviously pre, you know, Wilt's going to come to town pretty soon, and that's going to change a lot of things in Philadelphia. But after a couple years in the NBA wilderness, the Warriors get their mojo back thanks to the return to form of a former star and some fresh new faces. I believe the first time ever and always that the Warriors franchise will do this, where, you know, they'll have stars and they'll be good, and then some new faces will come in, and then they'll win a title. I think that's pretty much it.
All right.
Never happened again for the Philadelphia / Golden State / Warriors, whatever. Anyway, the Warriors of the early 50s, carried by Neil Old Hoss Johnson, who we've talked about many, many times, the best center of his time, not named George Mikan, while pitching Paul Arizin was in the Marines. He's gone fighting the war, and Old Hoss is ready to take over here. Arizin does return in 1955, but never really gets back his old form until this year, where he kind of gets back together. What happens, too, is Tom Golo, who joins the team, really helps things as a rookie, and the Warriors return to their championship form. Now, the debate between these two is going to be tough. Johnson, 22.1 points per game, 12.5 rebounds per game, 3.2 assists per game, 25.1 PR, 13.9 win shares. Great season for him. Paul Arizin, though, no slouch at all. 24.2 points per game, 7.5 rebounds per game, 2.6 assists per game, 21.3 PR, 12.2 win share. So great for him. Postseason-wise, I think you kind of see a separation here. Paul Arizin steps up big time, 28.9 points per game, 8.4 rebounds per game, 2.9 assists per game, 24.2 PR, 2.2 win shares. But Johnson, on the back of some really good shooting as well as some great rebounding, 20.3 points per game, 14.3 rebounds, 5.1 assists per game, 22 PR, 1.6 win shares. So this is tough. Curtis Harris, he would give it to Arizin. He would give him the lost 1956 Finals MVP award. But the best case for Arizin probably is that Johnson always put up extremely strong numbers, whether the Warriors won or lost, while Arizin's bounced back from good to elite really made the team go from like kind of middling team when he was out, and, you know, obviously when he returned, to then when he got back, they became a champion. So I think you look at it from that context, I think Arizin's got to be the best player on this team. I mean, he to me was more important to that team becoming great again than Johnston was. So I'm going with pitching Paul Arizin as the best player on the 56 Warriors.
Right. Well, yeah, the first year that Arizin left, you know, Johnston put up huge numbers, but the Warriors won like 12 games. Like, they were one of the worst teams of all time. And then now that wasn't Johnston's fault, but it does speak. I do think that, like, you know, Arizin was that guy who could raise their ceiling just because of that ability to take on the scoring load, the ability to, you know, make plays. You know, he was good off the dribble too, especially, you know, for his era, even though he was a forward. He and Yardley had a great duel in the 1956 finals. You know, so they both really performed well. And I do think that the way that Arizin stepped up, especially in the playoffs, and I think the fact that, you know, the fact that the team's fortunes seemed to rise and fall more with him than they did with Johnson, you know, leads me to agree that Arizin's probably the best choice here. All right, 1957 Celtics. This is the first team in the Bill Russell Celtics dynasty that won 11 titles in 13 years. You'd be tempted to default to him. But, you know, he's a rookie this year, only played 48 games that season. He actually joined the team in late December after the 1956 Summer Olympics in Australia, which were held in December because they were in Australia. And then summer is in December in Australia. So, but they were incredibly well. Yeah, they were very well balanced. You know, Russell, as well as Bob Cousy, Tom Heinsohn, Bill Sharman, all have decent cases as the team's best player. All four of them were in the top 20 in the league in PER and win shares per 48. So all really good. The Celtics were 28-20 with Russell, which is a 58% winning percentage, 16-8 without him, 67% winning percentage. So they were clearly an elite team, at least in the regular season, without him. Russell was second in the team in PER behind Cousy, fourth in win shares for 48. He led the league in rebounds per game. Cousy that year, well, he was MVP, so that's definitely a strong selection in his case. He was first team all NBA. Led the league in assists, and he was eighth in points per game. So he's scoring a lot as well, lead scorer. Sharman was sixth in the league in points per game, seventh in assists per game, although way behind Cousy's numbers in assists. He was also first-team All-NBA, led the team in win shares for 48. Heinsohn, he was rookie of the year, stepped up big in the playoffs. He led the team in points per game, was second in rebounds per game in the playoffs. And he also dropped 37 points, 23 rebounds in game 7 of the finals against the Hawks. That was a game in which Cousy and Sherman went a combined 5 for 40 from the field. But honestly, his case is probably the fourth best of the four. And if you look at their playoff numbers, the four of them, along with Frank Ramsey, who was, you know, their super sixth man, all range between 1.2 and 1.4 win shares in the playoffs. So, you know, trying to determine credit for all of these is tough. So, you know, of the three that we're looking at here, you know, is it the player who people believe to be the best on the team in the league at the time? You know, Cousy, which certainly did not have a bad case for that at all. You know, he was their big playmaker. You know, he drove the engine for them. You know, he was a great player. However, he'd been at that level for several years and they never won a championship before. Same case with Bill Sharman. You know, he's the best and most efficient scorer on the team, probably a little underappreciated historically. You know, the way that he was able to shoot the ball, come off screens, get to the line, and you know, he was the best free throw shooter of his era. So there's that. And then, of course, you know, you got Bill Russell, the foundational star. His defense revolutionized the league, obviously fuels the greatest dynasty in NBA history, and is going to be the best player for, you know, most of those teams, if not this one. I don't know. Rich, what do you think?
This is a really tough one. Because like you're saying, Cousy probably considered the best player of these guys in the league at the time. I mean, very soon after, people are going to really realize how great Bill Russell was, and he's going to get a lot of the credit for the success. But at this time, it's so close that optics wise, you're probably going to give it to Bob Cousy. I think we're going to give a lot of them to Bill Russell over the next decade. So I don't know, man. I think I go with Cousy, but it's a lot closer. I want to give it to Russell, though. I really do, because like you said, this is all of a sudden Russell comes here and all of a sudden, hey, we're winning titles, but nobody at the time really made that connection as much as we would obviously make it in hindsight, knowing how important Russell was. So I want to say it's a Cousy, but I really think you could coin flip this. I really, really do. I mean, Heinsohn and Sharman all have decent cases as well. This is a tough one. Now, we need a four-sided coin here to determine this one, I guess. So,
I'm also going to go with Cousy, but like, yeah, I feel it's extremely, extremely close between him and Russell and Sharman too. Yeah, if you wanted to go with any of them, I think you have a decent case for him.
Yeah, tough one for sure. All right, let's go to the 1958 St. Louis Hawks. And this is a pretty interesting one. I think it's a two-horse race, obviously, between Bob Pettit and Cliff Hagan. And I think it's a lot closer than people might think. But there's going to be one game, I think, that's going to determine this entire thing here. So Bob Pettit, obviously, default, you would say Bob Pettit's the best player on the 58 Hawks. And I'd mostly agree, and I think we will ultimately agree with that. But Cliff Hagan, very important to this team in the regular season in particular, and maybe more valuable in the playoffs as well. But again, there's going to be one game that I think is going to determine it all. And the narratives that will be written about the 1958 St. Louis Hawks will largely be on the back of this one game. So I'll tell you the numbers real quickly. Pettit has 24.6 points per game and 17.4 rebounds per game in the regular season. Not bad. Hagan is at 19.9 points per game and 10.1 rebounds per game in the regular season. Hagan has a bit of a better shooting percentage, 44.3% to Pettit's 41. Come playoff time, though, Hagan jumps to scoring up a bunch. So 27.7 points per game, 10.5 rebounds per game. His shooting percentage also goes over 50% as well, to 50.2%. Pettit falls a little bit, or he's about where he was in the regular season, I should say, 24.2 points per game and 16.5 rebounds per game. His shooting does drop a lot, though, to 39.1%. In the finals, though, Pettit plays like an absolute beast. Game 1, 30 points, 19 rebounds. Game 2, 19.7 rebounds. Game 3, 32 points, 19 rebounds. Game 4, he's not great. 12 points, 17 rebounds. But let's ignore it, because he's going to, in Game 5, get 33 points, 21 rebounds. And then in Game 6, the clincher, 50 points and 19 rebounds. This is going to be the most points in a finals clinching game in NBA history, until Giannis beat that in the 2021 NBA Finals. So this one is razor thin, but I'm going with Bob Pettit, because he put a 50 spot up in the clinching game. So come on. And it's Bob Pettit. Like, the default answer would probably be Bob Pettit, and you'd really need like Cliff Hagan to very clearly snatch us away from Bob Pettit. And I don't think he does. And Pettit putting 50 up in the final game, I think, makes the case for him to be the guy for this.
Yeah. I will say that Hagan Win shares wise in the playoffs, 27 win shares, sorry, 2.7 win shares versus 1.2 win shares for Pettit. So, so that significantly better there, obviously, but honestly, yeah, if it weren't for game six for the 50 points, 19 rebounds, I would pick Hagen. But it's really, really hard to
the 50-5-0.
Yeah. It's really hard to pick against the guy who had 50 points in the final game. Now, you know, in those finals, you know, Hagen had, you know, 33-8, 37-12, one game 18-4, then 27-15, 21-13. The final game he only had 15-6. So, yeah, I am gonna go. I'm gonna agree with Pettit. But if it hadn't been for if Pettit had just had a normal game in game six, I would have gone with Hagen.
Yeah, so, yeah, I agree. I think it's very, very close. And yeah, I'm glad we gave a little bit of credit to I mean, Cliff Hagen's a great, great player. And this, like, again, like on first glance, you're just like, oh, it's Bob Pettit. Because Bob Pettit, you know, you think of Bob Pettit when you think of the Hawks and sure, especially yeah, in this era. But yeah, I think Hagen does have a legit case. But yeah, that 5-0 is tough to tough to ignore. We are suckers for nice big round numbers. And yeah. Getting a 50 spot in the finals clutch game and keeping that record until 2021 is also just nuts. Like, you would just think that like a Jordan or somebody would have gotten there. No, nobody else got there until Giannis got there in 2021. So yeah, that's too much for me to handle. I like the round number too much. So it is Bob Pettit.
Yes. All right. So now 1964, 1965, 1966 Celtics. I'm going to try and make a case here for Sam Jones over Bill Russ.
So, all right, do it.
All right, so obviously for most of that Celtics run of eight straight titles between 59 and 66, no question that Russell was the best player. You know, six MVPs during this stretch, that's going to help. But, you know, yeah, there is a few times here where Jones at least puts himself in the discussion. So 1964, regular season, clearly it's Russell, 17.3 win shares to 8.9. But Jones did have an awesome postseason. He led the team points per game and by a large margin in win shares for 48, 2.90 to Russell's 1.9. Obviously, Russell still incredibly effective, and you know, not going to measure the stats are not going to measure the defense well, which obviously we're going to put Russell over Jones defensively. So,
yeah, I would do that. I think that's fair.
And fair, yeah. I'm picking Russell overall here, and I think it's a clear case, but I would say it's not automatic here. Which, you know, the other years previously, it's definitely automatically Russell. So, would you agree with that?
Yes, yeah, I would say that's. That's a safe assumption, or not even assumption, a fact. I'm down. I'm in it 100%.
All right. 65. So Russell wins his first, his final MVP here, the sixth MVP. First team All-NBA this year, which is the last time he would do that. Jones did earn his first second team appearance on the All-NBA. He was close to Russell in terms of regular season value and win shares 48. Actually was better than Russell in PER in the regular season. Also stepped up that season even more as a scorer, averaging 25.9 points per game. He was up to 28.6 points per game in the playoffs, which the, you know, Celtics were generally did not put the scoring load on one guy. They generally were balanced and, you know, had a few guys around 20 points per game. So this was unusual. But I will say Russell's PER and Winchester 48 numbers and overall numbers were far superior in the postseason this year. I mean, Jones played fine in the postseason, but did not play as well as Russell. And given that, you know, it's fairly close in the regular season and Russell had the better, you know, postseason numbers or better, you know, honors in terms of All-NBA and MVP, could also go ahead with Russell. But, you know, Jones definitely stepped up here. So any disagreement?
No, I think you got it. You tried, but it's
all right.
It's Bill. Yeah, sorry.
All
sorry,
right, Sam. So 66, Russell leads the team in PER and win shares for 48 in the regular season. Russell led an overall win shares. He nearly always played significantly more minutes than any other Celtic, including Jones. He averaged 47.9 minutes per game in that season. So,
like, Bill, you want to take a minute? No, I got it. It's like, we're winning by a lot, man. You can sit. It's cool.
Yeah.
I love Bill. Russell's the best. I got to just completely destroy the psyche of all these teams that we're playing. I just can never, ever. That's a crowd. 47.9 minutes. No, no load management in Bill Russell's day at all. So,
right. Yeah. So,
I hate to be like an old guy when the game was the game, but come on. That's incredible. That's right. Awesome.
That is incredible.
Yeah. I love it.
That's incredible. So, you know, Russell also, you know, stronger in the playoffs again, 19.1 points per game. 25.2 rebounds per game and 5 assists per game. So, again, I just don't see enough in any of these seasons, though I definitely, was trying to make the case for definitely, in some ways wanted to in any of these years. If there had been just one season where he was clearly better than Russell in both the regular season and the playoffs, there were times where, he was a bit stronger in the regular season or he was stronger in the playoffs, but he never clearly both in the same season. So honestly, I got to give it to Russell all three of these years, but hey, I tried, Sam. I really did.
Yeah, you did. It's just Bill Russell. Bill Russell. I don't know what to say. It's Bill Russell. Right. He's great. Doing this reminded me just how great he is and how angry I am when people do like top 10 list, especially now we're doing like the, with the Curry and we're like, oh, is he top 15 or top 10? And people just glance over Bill Russell. Dude, so good. Bill Russell, you heard it here first on this show. Bill Russell, I think he's good.
First time we've mentioned it. Yeah, I believe so.
Hot take, Bill Russell, good at professional basketball. That's
right.
Lay it out there right there. Deserves a little bit of credit for how good
I would say.
At professional basketball, yes. Mm-hmm. All right, well, speaking of Bill Russell being great at professional basketball, the 1968 and 1969 Celtics. But this is going to be an interesting one, though, because this was the focus of another great piece by Curtis Harris, as we mentioned, prohoopshistory.substack.com, the Lost Finals MVPs. This, of course, is the last finals ever to not have an MVP, so this is going to be it. For the discussion, we will now know who the voters voted the best of the best in every championship. Even though that's best in the finals, as we saw with Andre Iguodala many years ago, does not immediately mean the best player on a championship team. No offense to Iggy, but it tends to just obviously and as it's supposed to focus on the NBA finals, not necessarily the totality of the team or whatever. But in this article, like an absolute cop out here. Curtis selects both John Havlicek and Bill Russell, an unbelievable cop out at the end of the Lost Finals season. But it is really tough. I will give him credit because you can try all you can to try to figure out who the best of the best is on these, but it's really tough because this one's really tricky. Havlicek is in full swing at this time. Some of the now legendary Celtics of the years past are starting to take a few steps back or whatever, and they just become an insanely great, well-rounded team because it's like, hey, well, is Russell starting to get a little bit older? Is this guy starting to get a little bit older? Oh, here's John Havlicek to kind of just continue being great. But like we talked about when he passed away not that long ago, Sam Jones does not get enough credit for being like the stabilizing factor between two different, completely different Celtics teams in a lot of ways because he's going to lead the team in scoring in 1968 at 21.3 points per game. Havlicek is going to be second at 20.7 points per game. He's also going to add 6.7 rebounds per game. Bailey Howell, who will add himself to the conversation here at 19.8 points per game and 9.8 rebounds per game. And Bill Russell is still Bill Russell as he 12.5 points per game and 18.6 rebounds per game. So still doing pretty good. Only two contenders to me are those four, but that's a lot of contenders for the best team or best player on this team here. Pretty tight just using the regular season. Win shares is going to put Bailey Howard at 10.1, first among all those guys. Russell's going to be second at 8.2, Sam Jones at 7.7, and finally Havlicek at 7.6. When we look at the playoffs, though, it becomes a little bit clear for me. John Havlicek has 12.5 points per game, 8.5 rebounds per game, 7.5 assists per game, nearly a triple-double throughout the Celtics' 19 playoff games. Sam Jones is close at 20.5 points per game. And Bill Russell, an okay 14.4 and 22.8 rebound per game playoffs. So Bill Russell, good as usual. John Havlicek, I'm going to go with him here, due in large part to the finals, where the final game of the finals, where he scores 40, has 10 rebounds, and 7 assists. So I'm going to go with Havlicek. You could go with Bill Russell, but it's going to get kind of boring just always going with Bill Russell. So let's change it up here and give it to Havlicek, who I think a big part of the 1968 Celtics, obviously, and I think the best player on this team. Do you agree or disagree, Jason? Where are you with that one? It's real tough because Russell's right there for you.
Yeah, Russell's right there. Bailey Howell, I think, has a case, although he definitely dips significantly.
Yeah, his playoff runs, and we're going to see that in 1969 as well. He's like a really great regular season player, and then the playoffs come, and I'm not saying he doesn't plummet. Good. He's not bad, but it's like the other guys really kind of emerge as like far better pieces of these teams winning titles.
Yeah, Havlicek, especially that year, 2.8 win shares in the playoffs. Russell is at 1.6, win shares in the playoffs. So pretty significant difference there. I mean, as you mentioned, the Celtics definitely, they're they're a balanced team with those guys. Don Nelson also pretty strong for that team, especially in the playoffs. So, you know, they had a lot of guys contributing, but I would say that this is, yeah, this is definitely the first year, I think, where it's, I think Havlicek does have the stronger case than Russell overall. Obviously, you also have to consider is Russell's defense and all the things he did to drive and lead the team. He's also the coach of the team. So, you know, there's some of those things I would say would, you know, go in Russell's favor, and you definitely could make that choice. But I do think that Havlicek has enough of a case to, I would put him over Russell here.
And 69 is another tough one as well. So Havlicek is going to lead the team in the regular season 21.6 points per game. He's also going to add 7 rebounds per game and 5.4 assists per game. Bailey Howell, again, as mentioned, he adds himself to the mix. 19.7 points per game, 8.8 rebounds per game. Bill Russell falls a bit in terms of peer stats. His scoring falls under 10 to 9.9, but he still chips in a cool 19.3 rebounds per game. Bill Russell, good at basketball again. Yeah. And those are going to be the only three I'm going to consider for this one. Sorry, Sam. I'm taking Sam Jones out of this one here. Come playoff time, though, I think Hondo pulls away just a little bit too much. 25.4 points per game, 9.9 rebounds per game, 5.6 assists per game. Bailey Howell, again, he falls off a pretty big amount come playoff time. And I say fall off a pretty big amount. 15 points per game and 6.6 rebounds per game isn't bad, but it's not what Havlicek is putting up there. And Bill Russell shockingly shows up biggest in the playoff time, gets a scoring up against over 10 again, 10.8 points per game, and grabs a ho-hum pedestrian 20.5 rebounds per game. Win shares tells a very similar story as well. 2.8 win shares for Hondo. Howell drops to 1.6 win shares, and Russell is at 1.4. So if we just counted the regular season, I think Bailey might be the pick here, as he's really, really good. He led the team pretty comfortably in regular season win shares, but his play falls off pretty big in the playoffs. I think on the back of being the better player in 68, I think Havlicek takes it here as well. But I do want to give it to Russell, because Russell is so great, and he steps up big time in the playoffs. But I think Havlicek gets it back-to-back years here in both 68 and 69.
Yeah, I think Havlicek honestly has the clearer case in 69 than he does in 68. I think it's neck and neck, Havlicek and Russell in 68, and Havlicek is slightly better. I think it's more clear that it's Havlicek here. I think, you know, stronger overall. You know, he really upped the scoring, of course, and does it, you know, pretty efficiently. You know, Russell slips a bit. He has a strong playoffs, but he definitely slips in terms of, you know, scoring and everything. So, and then, yeah, like you said, Billy Howell, strong regular season, some of the advanced stats like him, but, you know, definitely, again, falls in the playoffs and isn't shouldering as much of a load as Havlicek was. He's efficient, but he's not nearly trying to do as much scoring. He doesn't play nearly as much. You know, it's really Havlicek and Russell who are the two engines, you know, driving this.
Yeah, and especially in the playoffs, you see that they're like, all right, let's just, you know, Havlicek's going to step this thing up and go. But yeah, right. And Russell, too, at the same extent. So Howell's very important in the regular season for them. But when you include the playoffs, I think Havlicek has this pretty clearly.
Right. Yeah, and I think this might have been the first year where somebody played more minutes per game on a Celtics team. Well, maybe not rookie year, but other than that, like, in the playoffs, you know, actually Havlicek plays more minutes per game than Russell did, you know, 47.2 versus 46.1. So, yeah, really
getting old. Bill's getting old. Getting lazy, getting old and lazy.
Exactly. Yeah.
Only what, 40, would you say, is minutes?
46.1.
I mean, oh, this bum. You know what I mean? Yeah. Load management. Look at this guy taking himself out of games for 3 minutes.
Exactly. So, all right. 1969 Oakland Oaks. We got some ABA action here. So fun times. Yeah. Yeah. You look at this roster and you think, oh yeah, like Rick Barry's on this team. So he's, you know, one of the greats of his era, you know, probably among the top 30 players in NBA history or so. Don't quote me on that, but that probably would be around there. So, however, only played 35 games that season because of injury. And to be clear, he was superb when he played. 34 points per game, 6.15 true shooting, which is great, especially for that era. 9.4 rebounds, 3.9 assists with a 0.301 win shares per 40, which is incredible. One of the best numbers ever. Even led the team in win shares overall, despite missing over half the season. So, you know, in terms of the best player who played for this franchise in the season, Rick Barry, no question. However, he missed the playoffs entirely. It's hard to make an argument he was the best player on a championship team, but he didn't even play on the team when they won the championship. So would you agree, Rick Barry, with all that with Rick Barry?
Yeah, he's a bomb. Rick Barry is just an absolute bomb, basically. I think is what you're trying to get at. You're trying to do it nicely, but yeah, Rick Barry stinks is what I have to say. So no, I'm kidding. But he's going to get very upset if he hears this. We better not.
Yeah, it's not that
he
hard,
hears you so. Anytime you're... he's like Santa Claus. He knows when you're sleeping. He knows when you're shooting overhand free throws and missing some. So yeah, that's...
Right. Yeah, he knows when you're talking shit about him. Yeah, so... Who else do we have? Well, like all the best ABA teams, you got a bunch of cast-offs and ne'er-do-wells. So, first, we got Doug Moe. Larry Brown's partner.
Is he, are you calling him a cast-off or what is Doug Moe?
Ne'er-do-well? I don't know. Well, the listeners decide that one.
Oh, man.
He came over from the New Orleans Buccaneers. They were the runners-up the prior year in the ABA Finals. This year, he was second-team All-ABA. He'd been first-team the prior year. So, you know, is regarded as among the league's top five, top ten players. Advanced stats don't like him quite as much as his reputation. He's only fifth on the team PER, fifth in playoff win shares, even behind Brown and journeyman center Jim Eakins. But Mo, probably regarded as the next best in the team overall, reputation-wise, after Barry, and he would later be named to the ABA all-time team. So, you know, great credentials there in terms of it, interest player. So that's his case. You've got Rookie of the Year guard Warren Jabali. He was the MVP of the ABA playoffs, 28.8 points per game, which is up from 21.5 in the regular season, 12.9 rebounds per game. Also made the ABA all-time team despite playing for five franchises in his seven-year career. And there are lots of stories and loose balls about him being, well, let's call it a challenging personality.
I was going to say, not a cast-off. I think he's a...
Right. More of an ne'er-do-well.
Yes. Yes. I would say Warren Jabali. Certainly more, not the cast off, more the ne'er-do-well, but awesome player, though. Awesome player when he wasn't challenging.
Right, exactly. And then the other best case, probably forward Gary Brad. So I honestly have to admit, I don't ever remember hearing about, even though he was the national player of the year. He played at Ohio State right after with Jerry Lucas. You know, he was like two-time Big Ten MVP. You know, for he was one of the sort of the end of that great run for Ohio State in the early 60s. This was his first season in the ABA. He'd had a brief NBA career, also had a stint in the North American Basketball League. Was Barry's replacement as a starter. He averaged, 20-10 in the postseason. So, next to Jabali, probably the Oaks' best playoff player. He was second on the team overall in win shares during the regular season. So, I think it's a strong case, but honestly, I think Jabali, just since he had that kick-ass playoff run, no one really stood out enough in the regular season to override that. I am going to go with Jabali here.
Yeah, I think that's a great case. Yeah, his playoff numbers are just tough to – yeah, you can't really debate those. Those are pretty awesome numbers. 28.8 points per game, 12.9 rebounds per game. I think Jabali's got to be the pick here.
All right, there we go.
All right, 1970 Knicks, Willis Reed or Walt Frazier, the only two contenders for me. No love for Dick Barnett. I'm sorry, Dick. You're out of this one here. Two-person race between Reed and Frazier for sure. So Willis Reed played 81 games of the regular season, led the team in scoring at 21.7 points per game and 13.9 points rebounds per game. I shot 50.7 from the field. Walt Frazier plays in 77 games. He's second on the team in scoring at 20.9 points per game, 8.2 assists per game, and even chipped in 6 rebounds per game as well. He shot an awesome 51.8% for the field. For Walford, that is an awesome, crazy efficiency for a guard who did so much else on the court as well. Let's give some love to Walt Frazier there. 20 points per game, 8 assists per game, shooting 51.8% from the field, and also grabbing 6 rebounds. I mean, just a great, great season for Walt Frazier. Win shares is going to give a little bit more love to Walt at 15 win shares, but Willis is right there at 14.6 win shares as well. So Frazier has a slight edge in win shares per 48. Maybe the playoffs will help us settle it. The playoffs, Reed is dominant. He has 23.7 points per game, 13.8 rebounds per game, both team highs. His shooting percentage just fall a bit to 47.1. Walt's scoring is going to fall a bit to 16 points per game, but he is going to chip in 8.2 assists per game and 7.8 rebounds per game. Very nearly a triple-double in the playoffs. Walt has a slight edge in playoff win shares at 2.8, thanks to his, you know, do-everything game. Reed has a slight edge in win shares per 48. God, we're razor thin here. I don't know what we're going to do. So let's see what happens in the finals. Well, crap, both guys are very, very good. Reed has 23 points per game, 10.5 rebounds per game in the finals. Frazier has 17.6 points per game and 7.7 rebounds per game, as well as 10.4 assists per game. So both averaged double-doubles in the finals to help their team win the championship. Both guys are big personalities. Willis Reed, obviously, at that time, is just kind of a legend in New York. But goddamn, Walt Frazier's a legend in New York at this time, too. Right. I have no idea. I'm going to coward. I'm going to call it a tie. Jason, it's up to you. You have to pick. All right.
All right. Well,
I can't do it. I'm a coward. I'm out.
Obviously, Reed, you know, the Willis Reed moment, the inspirational, you know, coming out of the court in game seven and, you know, rallying his team to the championship.
But real heads know that, right, Walt was the guy. You know what I mean? Like,
actually, yeah, it did it in the game. You performed, you know, incredibly in that game. Frazier and Reed were both all NBA first team that year. Reed was the MVP that year. Right. So, you know, now a future us knows that Frazier, we're going to pick Frazier, and it's going to be very clear in 1973. So it's tempting to pick Reed here. So Reed gets his due. I think Reed, you know, obviously won the MVP, and I think was largely seen as the better player at the time. Now, we know that Frazier's contributions, I think, were a bit underrated to the team. They were also a very balanced team that had a lot of, you know, really good players. You obviously Dick Barnett, Bill Bradley, as well. I think I'm going to go with Reed, but it's the slimmest of margins.
It's an optics one. I think because their play is so close and so similar that, yeah, I think maybe it's worth doing like an optics play in this one and say like who, you know, if we take ourselves into 1970 and think, okay, who's the best player on that Knicks team? Like you said, people are probably going to go with Willis Reed. Willis Reed had been more established at that time. Walt Frazier, this is his first All-Star season. And obviously, with hindsight being 2020, we know that for the next decade, he's going to be great. He's going to remain great. And he's going to be a big part of them winning another title, you know, later down the line. But yeah, I think it's Reed right now. He's the league MVP. He comes out, is the emotional leader of that team. I think if we did this show at this time in 1970, a week after the finals or a couple days after the finals, I think you and I would both say Willis Reed at that time. You know, hindsight being 2020, we might go with Frazier, but I think your pick of Reed is perfect in my mind. So,
All right,
I'm down. Thank you for settling the debate.
All right, thank you. I appreciate. Well, thanks for setting me up. Thanks for your alley-oop where I can slam dunk it. So, I always said you were a good assist man.
Thank you.
So, the Pacers, 1970, 1972, 1973, the true dynasty of the early 70s, in the ABA, of course. 1970, we've got guard forward Roger Brown. He was the playoffs MVP, second team All-ABA that year. But we also have center Mel Daniels. He is he's in his third of four straight first team All-ABAs. He was also a two-time ABA MVP, did not win this year, but he would win the subsequent years, his second of his two MVPs. The first one came when it was with Minnesota. If you're looking at the numbers, Brown averaged 23 points per game on 57 true shooting, 7.4 rebounds, 4.7 assists, a 20.6 PER, leading the team in win shares. Meanwhile, Daniels, also excellent, 18.7 points per game on 51 true shooting. So the efficiency, not strong, but he rebounded incredibly well, 17.6 rebounds, a 20 PER. So very, very close in PER. However, Brown definitely was stronger in the playoffs. 3.5 win shares to Daniels' 2.1. He averaged 28.5 points per game, 10.1 rebounds per game, 5.6 assists, closing out the LA Stars with 45 points and 11 rebounds to win the title. You know, a great clinching game. I think it's another case. It's sort of similar to the Pettit and Cliff Hagan issue where, you know, extremely close, but I think that Brown definitely in this game, especially having that, you know, that final game in the playoffs, I think kind of clinches it there. You know, I think his scoring load and efficiency outweighing the rebounding and, you know, other, you know, talents of Daniels. So what do you think?
I'm with you. Yeah, I think you're right. And especially Brown just, there was a little bit more for him, I think, in the case. So, yeah, I think you're right there with Brown. I think he's the pick.
Yes. So now we're in 72. Again, I would say between Daniels and Brown, although Freddie Lewis at least warrants a little bit of discussionary, he was the ABA playoffs MVP. So that's an interesting honor for him. Despite winning the title, the Pacers actually had no all-ABA players that year on either the first or the second team. Now, they'd slipped a bit in the regular season. Their key players were aging. It does kind of make sense, but it's a little bit surprising.
Yeah, it's at this point, it's more of a well-rounded team than, like, one dude being dominant. So it does make sense. But, yeah, it is kind of strange that, yeah, they're going to win the title and be as good as they are and not have any guys. But I do get it at the same time.
Sure. And Daniels now, he led the team points per game, rebounds per game, PER, and win shares. Clearly the top player in the regular season. Definitely better than Brown. Brown did step it up in the playoffs, led the team in PER and win shares, averaging 20.5 points per game. Daniels, 15.3 points per game, 15.1 rebounds per game. So his numbers are still strong. You know, Lewis, honestly, he was clearly the third best pacer to me. He did step up in some clutch moments, which probably was what fueled the playoffs MVP. In game 7 against Utah in the semifinals, he hit a couple of clutch free throws with 24 seconds left and ended up sealing the win. He also helped lead the team to a comeback from a 20-point deficit in game 5 against the Nets in the finals and hitting the game-winning free throws with 17 seconds left. So clutch free throws were definitely Freddie Lewis's thing. And definitely did well with it. You know, if you look at advanced stats in the playoffs, you know, Brown had 2.6 win shares, but Daniels wasn't too far behind, 2.1 win shares. So they both performed really well in the playoffs. I'm going to go ahead with Daniels here, I think, just because he was clearly better in the regular season. In the playoffs, it's honestly really, really close. So I think I would give it to Daniels here.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think his regular season helps a lot and steps up. Yeah, I think he's the good pick here for sure.
Yeah. Now we got 73. So we got a new horse in this race. We've got George McGinnis. He had been on the prior Pacers team and was good, but not me. You know, he clearly steps up into, you know, superstar level type play here. Wins the playoffs MVP, earns second team all ABA, 27.6 points per game, 12.5 rebounds per game, leads the team in PER and win shares. Daniels, definitely the number two pacer in the regular season, 18.5 points per game, 15.4 rebounds per game, also earned a second team all ABA appearance that year, was the last time he was on an all league team. And Brown, you know, honestly, yeah, definitely he fell off in the regular season, 12.6 points per game, you know, no longer one of the best players on the team, at least in the regular season, but in the postseason, he bounces back to now the box score stats. He's are actually not significantly better. He's more efficient, but they're about, you know, he's 12.6 points per game in the playoffs. So he's not necessarily completely launching his game, but he did have 2.1 win shares in the playoffs, which right behind McGinnis at 2.4 and Daniels at 2.3. So they're all, you know, roughly equally as valuable, at least according to win shares in terms of, you know, what they're giving you in the playoffs, you know. And definitely going to choose McGinnis here because he's clearly the best player in the regular season. And like I said, it's basically toss up between value in the postseason. But McGinnis really, you know, he's the workhorse of this team. You know, he's taken the load. You know, he's continuing this dynasty with, you know, Daniels getting older and still effective. You know, Brown, you know, kind of hit or miss. You know, and the other players who are fine, but, you know, definitely are not among the best players on this franchise.
Yeah, I think that's the right pick there. Clearly, McGinnis at this time has kind of assumed that role as the best player on this team. The other guys are kind of secondary dudes. You obviously need all those guys, you know, to win this title, and you need all these guys to be great. But yeah, McGinnis to me, just very clearly, between the regular season and continuing that play in the postseason, he's the pick here. So that's interesting. Yeah, so you actually end up with, what, three different guys here. You have 70... Right. Brown, 72, Daniels, and 73, McGinnis. I love it. It's a perfect representation of that team in that era. It's just every single year, it seems like a different guy is the best player on the team, and that's what made them great, is that there were so many good, you know, very well-rounded all-around team. So.
Right, and it, you know, and outside of the, you know, the Spurs, I don't think there's any, you know, of the great teams in NBA history, I don't think anyone, there's any other franchise who can say that they had three best players during their run. Than other than the Pacers. Yeah. You know, that, I mean, Spurs, we'll obviously get into that when we talk more about the Spurs, but yeah, outside of that, everyone else had at least, you know, had one or two best players. So this is kind of interesting.
72 Lakers, not going to be as much of a debate, unfortunately. I believe it is either one of Jerry West or Wilt Chamberlain. But it is tough between those two because we're talking about one of the greatest teams of all time, the 69-win Los Angeles Lakers. Famously, the year that the Lakers and coach Bill Sharman redeployed Wilt Chamberlain, not so much as the dominant, insane scorer he had been in years prior, but instead they wanted him to be a little bit more of an all-around player. His shot attempts plummet from 15 per game the prior year to just 9.3 shot attempts per game. Considering he was at 39.5 shot attempts per game in his 50-point season, that's a pretty big career switch for Wilt. And you know, as his career is starting to wind down a little bit, and the Lakers say, hey, maybe there's a better way that we can utilize you and get touches for everybody else. And it works because, you know, team is one of the best ever, and they win a title, and they're very good. But there's still a case that Chamberlain is still in the running here, despite not being, you know, the dominant scorer he was in years prior. So in the regular season, Wilt plays 42.3 minutes per game, has 19.2 rebounds per game, and 14.8 points per game. On its face, Jerry West seems like the obvious best player due to his 25.8 points per game and 7.9 assists per game output. Shockingly, though, West is not the leading scorer of this team. Gail Goodrich is at 25.9 yeah. points per game. I think I knew that, but then I was kind of like, wait a minute, right. Yeah, Gail Goodrich scored more than Jerry West that season. So the combination, though, of points and assists, I think, puts West in the conversation more than Gail Goodrich. So sorry to Gail. I'm going to knock him off of this one and just have it be Jerry West and Wilt Chamberlain. And especially optics-wise this time, I believe it's probably between one of these two. No offense to Gail Goodrich, but I think most people in 1972 would debate, you know, West and Chamberlain, not necessarily Gail Goodrich. But let's talk about win shares and the playoffs. So Wilt's going to lead the team in win shares at 15.8. He's going to have the lead at win shares per 48 at 0.219. West is going to be second on the team in both win shares at 13.3 win shares and 2.16 win shares per 48. So it's pretty thin. It's razor thin at this point. A tough choice. The playoffs, I don't know if we're going to get any hindsight here or any help in the playoffs. We're going to have to maybe make a tough decision here. In the playoffs, Wilt has very similar numbers. 14.7 points per game, so right in line with what he had in the regular season. 21 rebounds per game, still on roughly 9 shots per game, so he kind of sticks with what worked in the regular season. Jerry West, once again, the second leading scorer. Gail Goodrich, once again, the top scorer. Maybe we do have to add Goodrich to this mix here. But West has 22.9 points per game, 8.9 assists per game, so just great, great season. Great postseason, and we're pretty split here. Where we can finally, I think, split the two is the advanced numbers in the playoffs, which, and I'm not a huge, you know, using win shares and win shares per 48 for, you know, 1973 or 1972 is kind of tough here, but it is going to help us in this debate, I think, though, because Wilt is going to have 3 win shares, and that's going to blow away West's 1 win shares, because Wilt is going to be great defense, great rebound, and great efficiency, all this sort of stuff in the playoffs. Wilt's win shares per 48, 0.205, while West drops all the way to 0.078. Come on, Jerry, step up a little bit here. It's going to be in large part due to West. His shooting is not going to be great in the playoffs, 37.6% from the field, while Wilt is efficient as hell because it's Wilt, and he's shooting from, you know, 2 inches away from the rim, and he's just putting it in the rim, and it's a lot easier when you do that. So this one is tough, but I'm going to go with Wilt Chamberlain as the best player on the 72 Lakers. And I think also optics-wise of taking the, you know, the guidance of Sharman and the Lakers and saying, hey, don't shoot as much, do the other things that you do well, and that's going to help us, and him kind of sacrificing for the team and it resulting in them just immediately becoming like one of the most dominant teams of all time, if not the most dominant team of all time, obviously, until some future teams are going to contend with that. Right. So I'm going to go with Wilt, but I think you can easily choose West in here. And I think, yeah, if you really wanted to, you can make a case for Goodrich, I guess, but I'm going to go with Wilt as the number one guy here.
Yeah, and West's playoff struggles, I mean, that was a big, I mean, that was known at the time. And it's not just like looking in retrospect, it's like, oh, he really sucked. I mean, West lamented in his book about like, oh, he finally won a championship. It was so great, but he really, you know, it tortured by the fact that he played so poorly. And just
poor Jerry West, just the tortured human being. It's like, I never can win, and then I win, but I suck. God.
I'm gonna go with Wilt as well. This is also a very close one. I could see where people would go. I mean, you know, West was all NBA first team. Chamberlain was second team behind Kareem at the time. They both were all defensive team. So, you know, I mean, it's not like Wilt was, I mean, obviously Wilt was like in the tail end of his, well, both were in the tail end of their career, but and obviously Wilt wasn't scoring or as productive in certain ways anymore, but he was still seen as one of the elite players in the league. He's obviously, you know, has a great season, and numbers wise, you know, in terms of value, they're very close to each other in the regular season. I think it's the fact that Wilt just kind of blows it away in the playoffs or is going to swing it there for me.
Yeah. All right. We agree.
All right. All right. Last one for part one, 1974 Celtics. Is it Havlicek or Cowan? So really close to the regular season, by the way. This is the first year we get steals and blocks and box score plus minus tracked here. So giving us some better metrics than win shares to look at stuff. So Cowan's, he's a center. He's age 25. 19 points per game on 47% true shooting, 15.7 rebounds, 4.4 assists, 1.2 steals, 1.3 blocks, 1.9 bucks for plus minus. So very balanced. Didn't have any all NBA honors this year, interestingly enough. He won MVP the prior year. Of course, it's tough with Kareem and Wilt and all the other great centers being in the league. It's tough to get on that list, but a little bit of a surprise he didn't get there. Forward John Havlicek, 33 years old, so obviously late in his career, although he played for a long time. 22.6 points per game on 51 true shooting, 6.4 rebounds, 5.9 assists, 1.3 steals, a 2.0 block for plus minus, so also well balanced and also extremely close to the same value in terms of block for plus minus. Also very close in PER in win shares for 48. Havlicek was first team all NBA and first team all defense. The fact that did surprise me was the fact that Cowens was not on either defensive team list, considering his reputation for defense. He would be there, I think, more later in his career. But yeah, they're both very complete players. Cowens' rebounding and block shots obviously stand out, but so does his scoring and efficiency. So then we go to the playoffs, and it is a bit of a different story. Cowens puts up similar numbers, 20.5 points per game on 46 true shooting, 13.3 rebounds, 1.2 steals, 2.3 box score plus minus, so pretty similar levels in terms of they're up a little bit, down a little bit, but close to the same value. Havlicek steps up big, especially in terms of scoring. 27.1 points per game on 53 true shooting, 6.4 assists, 6.4 rebounds, six assists, 1.3 steals per game, 5.8 box score plus minus, and he won the finals MVP. So I would say Havlicek it is in the landslide once you put the postseason numbers in there.
He's piling up this Havlicek guy is piling up a lot of these here.
There you go.
Bad, not a bad player. Also a hot take. Havlicek good at basketball, but yeah, he's a guy. I don't know if we all give him enough credit. He's a great player, like a really, really great player.
Right. I mean, I think he's sort of like his individual, because he really emerges late 60s into the 70s to be that great player where in this, you know, he's part of that machine for the Celtics. He's really good, but he's behind a lot of guys early on in that Celtics dynasty. So
right.
It's sort of a weird. Yeah, it's like he was held back a little bit because, you know, of the framework that he was in, but it absolutely worked well for him and well for his team. So, it's weird because he's one of the most celebrated guys in NBA history, and he had that retirement tour, and he's beloved, but also, yeah, maybe not quite as seen at the level that he should be. If he were, like, the best player in, like, trying to think of a random team like Trailblazers history or something. Like if he played for a different franchise or the Bulls, if he played for the Bulls during that time and he was the best player on the 60s and 70s Bulls, he might be seen as like a top, you know, five ever of all time Bull, where like he's top, you know, he's one of the best Celtics, but there's so many great Celtics. It's like he gets falls on the wayside.
Right. He's helped by being a part of the Celtics, which helps kind of ease him into the league. And then when he's ready to go, he's part of, you know, championship teams, but he's also hurt by that because he's like one of 10 just elite level Celtics of all time. So he gets kind of lost in the mix. You're absolutely right. It's a great call there.
All right, well, end of part one. We will come back and talk about more modern league history, some fun debates going on. But this was fun, Rich. I appreciate you doing this with me.
Yeah, this is great. I'm excited. Yeah, we got some really, really fun teams to debate. I think, you know, the all-time big debate here, the 2004 Pistons, we'll talk about in the next series or the next show. As we said, the Spurs, very interesting in the mid-2000s because it's, you know, there's cases to be made for people that are not Tim Duncan several times. And then we're gonna get some fun ones as well as we go to the Lakers, the late 2000s Lakers, and debate that. Even the 2020 Lakers, we're gonna have a debate about them as well. And then I think it's also be really fun too to look at the KD and Steph Warriors, where that gets you know, Steph is very clearly the 2022 and the 2014 guy, but like those years, Kevin Durant, good player, really good,
not bad. Yeah, we'll see where it goes. Well, thanks everyone, of course, for checking us out. You can find us on social media at Facebook and Twitter at Overback NBA. If you have any feedback on the show or you want to have any opinions on part two before we end up recording that, you can share your thoughts there, see what you liked, what you didn't like, all that good stuff. You can also find us on any of the major podcast platforms. If you want to leave us a rating and review, we would appreciate that. It helps other people find the show. So thanks a lot for listening. We'll be back again soon.